And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast.
This is Inside Conan. I'm Mike Sweeney.
I'm Jesse Gaskell.
And we're excited to be together again.
We are. We can't get enough.
We're together every day. We're excited to be together with microphones. It's a whole different dynamic.
So this is the podcast where we show you behind the scenes of the Conan show.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn right along with you how a late night show gets made.
It's a real eye opener. I had no idea.
I know. I've only been working in late night for 10 years.
I learned something new every time.
I really do.
Today we actually learned a lot from our guests.
Yeah. I learned that some of my coworkers are very qualified to do their job.
I was stunned at the resume of one of our interviewees today.
Me too.
It's very impressive.
So people deserve to be here. It's kind of cool.
Yep.
So today we are going to talk to comedian Moses Storm. He was on the show this week.
Yes.
He had some incredible stories.
He, you know, stand-up comics generally have interesting childhoods. His is way up
there,
I
think. His takes the cake.
It's way up in the top 10.
Yeah, so he told us about growing up with parents who started an unsuccessful cult.
Right.
If a child came up to you now, you'd be like, hi. That's very bold of you. Hi. So it's like, yes, whatever you're about to say. Yeah. And I'd be like, yeah, head of hell. And they're like, what's that?
H-E-E-L.
Right. And then I would hand them like a propaganda flyer that my dad had drawn of Mickey Mouse getting crucified.
Man, it's bad enough saying you grew up with parents that started a cult, but one that didn't quite catch on.
I know. They weren't very good at it.
Oh, that's rough. Oh, we also talked to J.P. Buck. He books all the comedians on our show.
Yeah.
You know, we learned some of his secrets and also some of the things he looks for and how he does his job. And in today's world, he actually looks at comedians from all over the world.
Yeah.
I said world twice.
And he.
not ideal.
Go for a fourth.
Sorry. And his worldview really brings the world of comedy into us on a very intimate slash world basis.
Yeah, he gave, I thought, some really good advice for aspiring comics.
Yeah.
Who might want to get on a
late
night show. But first, Sweens.
Yeah.
What do you say we talk
Jesse,
about?
What? Sorry. Yeah.
What do you say we talk about what happened on Conan this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
The Conan show. We had some great guests this week. Some great comedy, too.
On the television show. Absolutely.
It's still a thing.
Yep.
Moses Storm, of course, who we're going to hear more from later. Bert Kreischer.
Kathy Bates was on.
Ugh, icon.
She's great.
And Timothy Oliphant.
Yes.
Who always has a really good rapport with Conan because I think they hang out
in real life.
Yeah.
Right.
So one of my favorite moments from the Timothy Oliphant interview. Mm-hmm. Oliphant, that's a hard name to say because
I'm glad you're
so
saying
much like
it.
Elephant.
I have no idea how to say it.
Conan always says the Oliphant in the room.
Yes.
One of my favorite moments was when they told a story of a fan coming up and
They're in a restaurant together,
yes.
I think. And yes, they're
someone came up and kind of perfectly insulted both of them in one fell swoop.
Beautiful. It was a real piece of
yeah, I was jealous.
Art.
She was so excited to see both of us. And she said, no, you don't understand. She said, if I could have a guy with, and she referenced to me, with your looks. And then she looked at you and said, and your brain.
It's awesome. She left, and both of us felt like shit the rest of the night.
One thing I don't think I realized until I started working for Conan is how often people come up to him and just say weird things.
And now the selfie with the advent of the smartphone, it's people just... They don't even ask anymore. They used to politely, like, could I get a photo?
Yeah.
And
now it's just like, hey, you, come here.
It literally is like, hey.
Yeah.
You see my phone, you know what you have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we know you're a trained celebrity dog. Get over
this
here.
This is a binding agreement.
Almost, I've seen it wordlessly done.
Yeah.
I like when they give me the the camera.
And oh, right.
Then I just take a selfie of myself.
But oh, that's
I never,
great.
I never tell them that.
I like what, sometimes it's great, when we've been traveling in other countries, people will ask for the photo and then afterwards they'll ask me, they'll say, who is that?
It's true.
They just know that it's someone that they want a photo with.
That's right.
Who's famous, and then they'll look it up later.
This will go with my other photo of people I don't know.
Yeah.
I like when they think he's a different host. That's always exciting. Yeah. We love that bit in the Cars.
Right. They think he's Martha Stewart.
We redid our kitchen based on your recommendations.
It's fun, though, because in other countries, he does a thing where he kind of mutters under his breath as a joke. He calls people murderer.
Right. Hilarious. And it's a compulsion.
It is. Yes. I do think it's a little bit of a tick.
I don't know if he, I wonder if he truly does it when he's alone. Like, I would be curious to set up some GoPros.
He's calling himself murderer.
Like, if he mutters it about people when there isn't an audience for it.
Yeah.
But he says it pretty.
He says it. Loud.
He will say it as loud as he
needs to. He'll say it really quickly, so I think most people don't know.
Murderer.
They're like, he didn't call me a murderer.
Right.
What did he didn't just say that.
Or maybe the people are like, oh, I guess those other people, one of the other people there is a murderer. But
yeah.
It can't be me. I don't even know this man, and I just served him his entree.
How would he know that I've murdered?
Right. You know, when he's in other countries, you think he would learn to say murderer in their native language.
In their language.
I think that would be a nice touch.
That would be a goal. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be respectful.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we digress. So, yes, the next time you ask for a selfie, you listen for the trailing murderer as he steps away.
Yes. And also ask, because it's polite.
Yeah.
Why don't we jump into our conversation with Moses Storm?
Oh, yeah. That would be great.
Yeah.
He has an amazing, as we mentioned earlier, an incredible backstory.
Yeah.
His childhood is one to savor. Check it out. Well, can we talk a little bit? You have a wild backstory. There's so many comedians I know who, you know, they almost love to. It's like a game to see who can outdo each other for having the most
fucked up childhood.
Right. And ooh, yours, right. I was very impressed.
But how fucked up it was. Yeah, it's very
an impressive
fucked up.
Legitimately. It wasn't like you
have bragging rights.
Manipulated things, yeah.
No.
Yeah, so my parents started and ran an unsuccessful cult.
Oh, they started it.
They started it.
I didn't know they were go-getters.
Do you think that's better or worse than if it had been successful?
I think, yes, it'd probably be a problem, but I do legitimately, outside of any sort of bit, I watch these Netflix documentaries and all these podcasts about cults, and I legitimately get jealous.
Right, like the Bhagwan,
of like, oh, they have these sex parties, there's gun running, there's like
private
FBI
jets.
Chases. Yes, mm-hmm. private jets. We had nothing. We had a bunch of neon signs, and no one cared.
So what, you said they failed. What were the most followers they had?
So they had zero followers.
Okay.
And then they—
Not even their children?
Just their children?
Oh. Yeah, they were like, let's make some.
Yeah.
And then they had five children, and then that's why I'm alive. For that purpose.
Right. But not even a neighbor who would casually—
People would hang around with us for little bit, but once they figured out that we didn't have weed, they'd be like, okay, no, this isn't—
What's the
Is
point?
Weed a big part of—
Well, you think because we would be like hippies, because on the facade of it is that we were in a bus— Traveling around.
You lived in lived in a bus.
We lived in a old Greyhound bus that they had ripped the seats out of.
Oh, Greyhound's nice. I was feeling bad for you. It was a school bus, but Greyhound has—
Okay. You've clearly never been on a Greyhound.
he tips the Greyhound
I
driver.
Do. Driver. Right. Steve it is, right, I believe? Oh, no,
What's
that was the guy
catch of
Delhi?
The day on this Greyhound? syphilis. And so they converted an old, beat up, broken down Greyhound bus into an RV themselves. Like, not well. They didn't do a good job.
Wow.
It didn't turn out at all. My dad built us bunk beds, but he forgot to measure for the mattress in the back.
Always a common bus turning into a home mistake.
It's the first thing you thought of when you live in your bus. You're like,
classic.
What were the size of the bunk bed?
Don't be angry at your father. It's not his fault.
But the reason that that I was just reminded of this, the reason that the bunks had to be so small in that particular area of the bus is so my parents had room inside of the bus for an industrial size cotton candy machine that we were going to, quote, make money off of.
Oh, that, so that was the side project.
That was like the side thing candy. Is that we'd show up and we'd yell at people like, you're headed for hell. And then Spun Sugar.
Oh. So some, did the machine was installed or just
it was
space?
It's an industrial size one. So once it's in there, it doesn't move.
Right.
And it gets
good for
so
the gas
hot.
Economy.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I love that even then they knew that they're like, we're not going to get people in. Based,
right.
Based
right.
The shot,
they already had a plan, yeah. A terrible plan B. There's no self-esteem. Steam in the cult. We're going to need a side hustle.
Did they also let them like throw baseballs at you guys or something? Or like some
no, that would
carny
be fun.
Games?
That yeah. would be fun. That's all like things that I'm like, yeah, they could have done all these things. Mm.
So would your dad have a driving itinerary every day? Or would you just...
Here's the other embarrassing yes. thing is that they got the bus to be like, we're going to go everywhere, right? We spent most of our time in Florida.
Yeah. Okay.
You can only stay in an RV park for 2 weeks at a time.
Right. Oh.
And my dad found two RV parks that were within 4 miles of each other. And we would just oscillate between the two parks for 6 years to the point where even hurricanes would come and hit the Gulf where we were living. And my dad would be like, we're going to ride it out.
We're going to ride it out. No.
In the rolliest of all the foundations. A bus.
Because you didn't have the gas money because of the cotton
the
candy
gas,
machine.
Cotton candy was just not.
That you got.
No one wanted
Spun
Sugar. 5 miles
a gallon.
Yeah.
This is incredible.
It's amazing story.
What were some of the tenets of this?
Of the cult.
So yeah. It's like a mix of Judaism, Catholicism, and Christianity.
Wow.
Sort of like a greatest hits. They kind of cherry picked all the least fun parts of those religions. So it's just like all rules.
Uh-huh.
Nothing that's pleasurable or
all
fun.
All shame.
All shame. Everyone you meet is essentially doomed, headed for hell. They would hate you.
Now, is cotton candy, is that under Judaism? Or is that, that's
cotton candy
Catholic,
is,
right?
Is their DMT. That's the way to enlighten
did they work?
Men.
Did they work the cotton candy into any of their tents?
No. That also would have been a great idea,
yeah,
right? You
yeah.
rope them in with a sweet treat.
Well, can they give it another try? Or are they?
They look back on it right now. It's like a little scary how they look back on it. They look back on it like how like white people look back on having dreadlocks in their 20s. It's like, well, that was
like
crazy,
that was whimsical,
man.
Yeah.
What was I thinking?
So they just laugh it off? Like, oh.
They laugh it off now, yeah.
Oh, 6 years like, in Florida.
Right.
Mm.
Did all the kids go into comedy?
No, everyone as like a rebellion got the most stable job and
I
became
see.
Just like a great father and is sending their kids to real school.
How many siblings?
They're all finance bros and they're all addicted to cocaine. No, they're all just like, they work at a grocery store or like they make contacts. So it's very like.
They learn to trade and actually,
Yes, they're just trying to like blend in. And I'm the one person that's like, I'm going to spin this into gold.
I'm still going to win mom and dad back.
Right.
My zany lifestyle.
This is all for them.
So do your parents, do they give your siblings a hard time for being straight?
Mm.
No, not at all. Because what happens when you have, or at least from a very young age, when you're sentient enough to be like, oh, my parents, they don't got it.
Right.
They don't got this. Is that the power dynamic shifts where you kind of become a peer with them. So it's just like, we're all in this together. Also, we were making more, if not the same amount of money as them.
With
our cotton candy, the weird side jobs that we would have. So there was never like,
so you
can
were
I have
contributing
money?
To the household from an early age.
Well, up until like even 3 years ago was still like giving my mom money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The moving every 2 weeks back and forth, would you be back?
Yes. I'm glad you
turned into
on
one.
That.
And were people like, did your dad be like, hey, we just happened to be in
right.
the area
yes.
2 weeks later? And
he tried to play it off. And then the embarrassing is RV parks are filled with people that are just traveling. So people would have all these great travel stories of like, yeah, we were just in Baton Rouge and then we went to Mardi Gras. And then we would be
and
like,
you guys were like, we were 100 yards away.
Have you been down the street? There's a gas station.
The 7-Eleven across town.
It's great.
Incredible.
The scratching lottery tickets there, almost all winners.
Would your dad put religious objects outside the bus once you landed? connected.
So at a Greyhound bus,
what would your yard
knowing that you've never seen a Greyhound bus, they have sometimes bus routes at the front.
Uh-huh.
These are these things that you yell at and you go, what's that train doing on this street?
Right.
In your leather Bentley.
Did yours say heaven? Next
it
stop, did. Heaven.
It always had like, you guys are headed for hell.
Right.
Like it always had something very eye-catching.
Yes.
So not, it wasn't subtle at all.
Why not go there with a delicious cotton candy?
Do you think that they would have, if they had known about the Westboro Baptist Church, would they have been a part of something like that?
No, because they took a lot of pride in their own thing. So they were against, so why they wouldn't claim that they're Christian or Jewish is that there's rabbis, priests, pastors, all those are wrong. It should be no middleman. It should just be you straight to God.
Mm-hmm.
So any,
except
any,
for them.
Yeah. Except for them, I guess. They could get you there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
To point you in the right direction.
Yeah. So, no, but they did, similar to the way, my parents would, like, try to get arrested, where it was, like, a badge of honor to, like, it's like, sir, you could just be on the sidewalk. You don't have to be in the intersection with that neon sign.
And they got arrested?
My dad got arrested once out of all the times he tried to get arrested.
He literally couldn't get arrested.
He couldn't get arrested. He couldn't.
Holy
get, well,
cow.
This is in Columbus, Ohio. He finally got arrested. He was at some street festival, and it was like the middle of the night. And they're like, "Just don't! Like the concert's letting out. We need to let people through, and you're in the street."
What was the concert?
It was like some music festival. I think it was like a Rusted Root concert.
He was like, we're going to pick some of them off and bring them to our side.
Yeah. Like, that's another thing. It's like, that's not the most receptive people. It's people leaving a concert or, or like spring break teens
trying to
screaming
beat the rush
on alcohol. That's not the people that are like, you know what I need right now? Some divine intervention.
A direct path to Yahweh.
Let me look at some of these misspelled propaganda signs. Oh, that's the other thing is my mom was, I'm going to talk about this on the show tonight, but my mom was also dyslexic. So
no overlap. No, sorry. Go
right. People
go
fake in the comments for this podcast.
Right.
My mom would, she would misspell some of the giant eye-catching signs, but they were so expensive to reproduce that sometimes she would just go out with a sign that said, you're headed for heel.
Oh my
God. Yeah.
That's a tough one to misspell.
That's the one. You try to drive it home.
She didn't want to be part of the cult. She was trying to undermine your dad, I think. Did you kids ever get in trouble?
Yeah. That's a lot of rules. And it's like a lot of the Bible goes
but I mean,
against
I mean, with
what
the,
kids are.
Like out in public with your parents, did anyone ever try to?
People would just be shocked.
Intervene or anything?
Yeah, no, yes. People would be like, this is wrong. Because I would be 2 or 3 years old, and I would just have like a loaded up sentence in my head where I would go up to an adult. And if a child came up to you now, you'd be like, hi. That's very bold of you. Hi. So it's like, yes, whatever you're about to say.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, yeah, I had it for hell. And they're like, what's that?
H-E-E-L.
Right. And then I would hand them like a propaganda flyer that my dad had drawn of Mickey Mouse getting crucified.
Oh my God. Is that real?
That's a very real.
That's just anti-Disney. Wow.
Yeah, that sounds like a cool tattoo.
I literally did. I remember that just in the moment, and the image of that is so funny. He's being crucified.
Of all the Disney characters.
It was like capitalism. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't exactly know what that's saying.
Now I would put snowman from Frozen on the
Yes,
the cross,
get him crucified.
That motherfucker.
Oh, get him out of there.
I don't even know his name. I don't
so
want
they,
to know his name.
Yeah, so he's into art.
Do you have any of these brochures?
Yes, I still have them in my personal collection. They're so full of hate that I can't like post them as like a Throwback Thursday joke.
Right.
Because they're so like, ugh, so intolerant, so gross that I can't get behind
But you're
it.
Saving them for the Hulu documentary about
Well,
your
I definitely,
parents.
I've over my bed, I have a giant framed crucified Mickey Mouse.
Leaving Greyhound is the name of the
Leaving
documentary.
Greyhound. Can't wait. Yeah.
Did they paint the Greyhound?
Yes, spray paint. And guess what? You could tell.
You was it crazy colors? Was it?
No, it was just like they tried to do a good job, which is even worse. It's like silver and teal.
No.
But spray paint does not go on like you hope.
Especially not after a couple hurricanes.
No, not at all. Everything would fall apart. My dad would always like, it was like before YouTube tutorials, he would like build a cabinet and it would just shatter the second you close it. Yeah. It was, and people would want to come in because like it was mostly just like honey wagons and real RVs. So people are like, oh my God, you converted your own bus? And they'd get maybe 2 steps in and be like, oh, okay, we're going to go. Well, you've got to show you the bag. You're like, no, no, we get it. We get it.
It was like, it really wasn't selling them when they saw the craftsmanship.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
So am I gleaning correctly? Your parents are still together?
No.
Okay.
Oh. No, they divorced around the same time that the religion kind of disbanded.
Oh, that
the religion started to allow divorce.
Right.
Yes.
And then immediately, yeah.
Do they blame, or did they blame each blame each other for the failure of the cult?
I think they just both wanted to have their 20s, and then that never happened because of the religion. So then in their late 30s, they got divorced and had a midlife crisis. My mom became a professional bodybuilder.
Wait, who did?
My mom.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So I would go to these contests as a kid, and nothing can prepare you for how boring a bodybuilding contest is going to be. It's just like 3.5 hours of people.
3.5 hours?
Flexing. Yeah, just flexing. Just like 92% nude people.
Did you
flexing.
Have to like oil her up for it or anything?
Yes. Oh. And that's a whole thing I got to open up in therapy.
Oh.
But backstage was honestly terrifying for me as a kid because you think like, oh, bodybuilders are strong. But when you see them in a contest, they haven't eaten or drank anything in the last 48 hours.
Wow.
So to like get defined.
Sure.
So the backstage, these fucking beasts would just faint left and right. And they'd fall on the ground. They'd like grab my arm to like steady themselves.
Oh, no.
And they'd like a self tanner mark on my arm.
But and they slid off because of the oil.
It slid right off. And then their trainer would start like reviving them and trying to squirt water into their mouth because like the human body needs that.
Right.
And then these bodybuilders would come to and they would start freaking out about all the calories they just ingested in the water. And start making themselves throw up on the ground. So I would be backstage and it's just these like piles of muscles wrapped in skin just regurgitating on the ground.
Vomiting.
Yeah.
To get rid of the water.
To get rid of any water weight.
That should have been the show backstage.
That, I would watch that, yes. Because the front is so boring.
Yeah.
These guys look like superheroes, but they can't do anything.
I'm just, you basically as a child had no idea what an adult looked like.
No idea, no.
Like, you did not have any...
No frame of reference for, like, this is a role model. This is...
With the bodybuilding, where you're like, finally, some normality in my life?
It was. It felt very stable. I was not sad at all about the divorce. It was like, here's two people that... A lot of 90s kids, like, hold this bad. Like, my parents divorced. Everything fell apart.
That was the most normal thing that
happened. I was like, thank God. These people are terrible together. They could finally, you know, have their own life. My dad was bi when they met, and then my mom thought she could change him, and that's not how gay works at all. So then 15 years later, he was like, no.
The bodybuilding was the last-ditch attempt.
That is a great point. That is a great point to be like, I'll give you the body you want.
Check out these pecs.
Oh, she would also never got that big. She never won anything because she was so vain that she wasn't willing
to actually do accrue muscles.
Yeah. Because they stopped doing the female contests because they're so unpopular.
Oh, is that true?
Because no one wants to see that. Yeah. There's like amateur ones, but there's not like Miss Olympia. Like they just stopped 5 years ago.
Right.
Because they would do the women's after and the entire audience would stand up and leave and it would be like me and then four guys with two blue tips in.
I oiled her.
Right. I oiled her up.
All right, kid.
Help reviving these things.
Well,
now
is she, I feel like she must have a third iteration now. Is she doing something else now?
She's in an RV again. She's got a new husband.
Oh, right.
And she just like... takes stuff from the trash and then cleans it up and like sells it at flea markets.
Oh.
And she gets to travel around a lot. She's still working out a bunch.
So they're actually traveling.
She's definitely leveled out and has become like a mom to us, like all the ways I wish she would have when we were younger. So it's a nice, really like
that's a happy
redemption
ending.
Story. Yeah.
I mean, it's not over.
It's not over, but I think
it's just a happy point.
Well, I think we've also become more tolerant too. The older I get and the more mistakes that I make as an adult, like I'm their same age when they had five kids. And I don't think honestly I could probably do a little bit better of a job. Probably wouldn't be in a bus, but I can't honestly say, cause I don't
You'd
have
be
any
on
children.
Conan's tour jet.
Right. Yes. That would be better. And that has a cult like environment.
I forgot to mention I'm bringing five children with me.
Right. In an industrial sized cotton candy machine that you cannot get around without getting.
We're losing altitude on account of the cotton candy machine.
What do we
can't
dump?
Stay up.
Dump fuel.
Couple of kids.
We can't lose the candy.
Real quick, just to go back, we're going to let you go soon. No, I promise.
Oh, I think Conan just did the show without Moses.
It's over. Yes.
Yeah, we definitely.
Simon, huge priorities. I think you chose correctly.
No, this was way better than whatever you're doing on the show.
Makes sense.
No, I'm sure it's great. The first time that you did stand up on Conan, what was that process like for you? What did you have to do to kind of get your set ready? Did you talk to other people who had done it before?
Yeah. You're supposed to like run your set a bunch before. I didn't have the luxury of doing that because at the time I was shooting a teen drama in Utah.
Okay.
And there's like one club there. It's like a Mormon club.
There's no alcohol or caffeine.
There's no alcohol. No, that's actually what happens. They keep the house lights on.
Almost cult-like.
Right. That's my base. And then they just sit with two Diet Cokes because you can't really have caffeine as a Mormon.
Right.
But you like the loophole is Diet Coke.
Right.
So they would just start with two Diet Cokes and they'd be dressed up like church and they would just sit there with the lights on. And that was the show. So it was like the worst place to run your set. So when I finally got here, flew in the like that morning of, got to do the show, it was such a warm audience and felt so.
And you're like, oh, people just will like, laugh I could just at fly. This.
And JP Buck books the comics on our show. Did you like? Is there a great amount of back and forth with him leading up to the show?
A lot, to the point where you get a little bit angry.
Right.
Where you're like, there's no, why? I have to change this sentence. And you run the set so much that I started bombing with the set that I originally wanted to do on the show.
Right.
Because it was so rehearsed. And you're going up to the comedy club where people are doing like 15, they're talking to the crowd. Right. I'm going up with like a word perfect.
A script. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And people can tell and that you're not having fun anymore. And then
JP's
so then
we the only one in the audience laughing. Oh, this is fantastic.
That's technically the word. But then I kind of scrapped that. And then just from doing all the roof shows, kind of retouched base with JP and then had a much funner, looser set.
I wonder if that's JP's plan all along.
Yeah, like he's trying to break us like a horse.
Right.
Yeah.
And build you back up. Break him down and build her up.
That's also a cult strategy, actually.
Yes. So that works on me.
The cult within.
I have noticed just like I am more comfortable around people that are mean to me. If you're like raised really religious, so you're just like, people are like, yeah, you're doing great. I'm like, ooh, gross. I don't trust that at all. So it was a great experience from being on the show, and it was a night and day difference after. Everyone says now that these sets don't mean anything.
Right.
They're like, no one's watching late night sets anymore. But for me personally, the set did well online. And
you said it opened doors for better clubs. And
Absolutely.
Wow,
and sitcom opportunities. It was a light switch. It was a very clear.
Oh, that's really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And I've pissed it all away. So now I'm scrounging around for another set today. Hey, you guys have any loose time?
Well, turns out we do.
Yeah. So I'm excited for today.
Good.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking
the time
to talk to us.
This is really fun.
I had a good time. I can tell that there are more stories in you, so we may have to have you back sometime.
I would love to.
Can you come back in 10 minutes?
Yes. In between in between the time I do a set on the show and the couch piece during that commercial break.
Yeah, I want to know the reps your mother was doing. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Moses. Good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk to J.P. Buck, Conan's stand-up booker.
We're back with Inside Conan. Here's our conversation with stand-up comedy booker on The Conan Show, J.P. Buck.
So we just had a fun interview with Moses Storm, and it made us start thinking about the process of how stand-ups get booked on the show. And so we wanted to talk to our guest here, JP Buck.
Hello, JP.
Hello.
Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a lovely studio.
Thank you.
They can't see it.
Thank you very much. And as Jesse said, you're in charge of booking all the comics who come, and we have a lot of stand-ups come on the show. So it's a big, big job.
Well, and I think our show has had the sort of reputation for really finding new voices and often giving opportunities to people who've never done stand-up on late night before.
Well, I mean, that all comes from Conan. He's been incredibly, incredibly supportive of young comics. And I think when we started here at TBS, he really wanted to really, I guess, swing for the fences and open up the gates to a lot of comics who may not be mainstream and also may not have gotten on on other late night shows. And so it's certainly kept me busy.
That's great.
So, JP, you've been with the show since The Tonight Show?
Yep, that's been about 10 years ago.
Cool.
How do you, what did you do before that? I'm interested in how you learn to do this job where it's like, oh, yes, I can book comics on a late night TV show. Were you booking live shows prior to that, or?
I was working for, you know, going between festivals and live performance shows, a bunch of talent shows, which I'm glad I'm not doing anymore.
Yeah.
I did the I don't know if you remember that Star Search did make a resurgence in about 2003.
Ooh,
hosted by anyone? Sort of. Anyone here?
Oh,
remember?
Man.
Regis Philbin?
No. Arsenio Hall.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it didn't last that long. They were trying to compete with American Idol. And I think they were, the comics had to do a minute and 40 set
on
national television in front of the Elder Judd. Is it Ash? Is it Naomi? No, when is it? Which one was that? Naomi or Wyona?
Miranda.
No, right. But she changed her name to Elder Judd.
She and Ben Stein would judge stand up comedy and comics. I felt after that I owed about 20 comics a debt of gratitude and I needed to find them better work elsewhere. So
that's how this job.
They had
came
to
about.
Do a minute 40.
Minute 40, and then be followed. And actually, I think they had to follow a child singer after, you know, and that's never good.
Sounds like Ed Sullivan.
Not a hot crowd.
No, not a hot crowd. And I did that, and then I worked for a number of years at HBO doing the comedy festivals in Aspen. And then worked for Montreal Comedy Festival. And actually, the last thing I did before I got here was working with Ellen DeGeneres on one of her TBS specials in Vegas.
Oh. That was a stand-up? She had stand-ups on?
Various performers. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think one stand-up, Pink performed. There's probably some acrobatics.
Mostly puppets.
she danced.
It is
and,
Vegas.
Yeah. But it was that was the last thing I was doing when I got the call.
Oh, wow.
About this.
Well, wow. Yeah. That's a ton of experience. I'd say you were overqualified. Holy cow.
So I was wondering, how do you generally find comics for the show, especially if it's people who are sort of more under the radar? Are you going to a lot of live comedy in LA? Do you see people online?
It's a mix. There's a lot of, I mean, nowadays, and in the early days, it was all going out and just, you know, going into a room you'd never been before, an open mic.
I bet you drank a lot.
Yeah, I gained probably about 20 pounds in the first couple of years doing this job.
Yeah, because you have to drink at those things.
Well,
to make it fun.
But then the problem is you book somebody thinking they're amazing, and then you're sober in front of your boss, seeing them on a late night stage, and it doesn't work as well.
Oh, yeah. Two drink minimum for our show.
But yeah, that was there's a lot of going out to live shows. There's a lot of festivals, the big ones, Montreal, Edinburgh, and then Bridgetown used to be a really great festival. In Portland, that's probably was my favorite place to go, is go up there.
It's not a good festival anymore?
Well, it's just they haven't, I believe it may, it was teetering on not going forward. So I think, unfortunately, it may not be going on anymore. Hmm. But festivals, and then I just get a lot of submissions, emails every day, links to videos.
Oh, wow.
And now so much of it is probably video.
Yeah. I probably watch most of my most of the sets on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
That's I would wonder about avoiding eye contact when you're when you're at a live club, comics
do people
kind
know
of,
who you are?
Do they zero in on you and then try to like engage you with like, hi,
it's not too bad. No, I think it's, I mean, I've been around, I think, long enough that I know a lot of the comedians already. So it's usually a friendly conversation.
Right.
There can be a couple here and there that may not be as pleasant because I haven't booked them.
Right. Do people get belligerent and kind of in your face a little
bit?
There's
been a couple. There's been a few instances of saying why the hell haven't you booked me?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Comparing themselves to other people I've booked, saying that they're better.
Yeah. Very smooth.
That's a surefire way
smooth.
To get booked somewhere.
Yeah.
Is to insult your taste.
That's exactly. I'm always wondering, like, well, what do you think? I'm
What's
doing?
Your end game here with this?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of that, but for the most part, I try to get out and see as much live. You know, I like to see them live, obviously, before booking for the show, but every once in a while, there'll be someone internationally who I just can't fly to, like, Sydney, Australia and see somebody, or I can't get to London in time, and the set's fantastic, and I kind of go on my gut going, okay, well, I guess this will translate to the stage.
And yeah, because that seems to be a big thing, that there are even, you know, emerging comedy markets like in India or mm-hmm. in the Middle East. And it's like people who I think for a long time didn't have any access to a stage, a comedy stage. So have you had experiences where you've like seen a international comic and wanted to fly them in?
Well, we had, I think one recently, it was about a year ago, Ismo was on our show.
Oh, yeah.
Right. He's a comedian mm-hmm. from Finland.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting story about him really quickly is just that he was the first submission I got when I joined here, when I got to the Tonight Show. Mm-hmm. Frank Smiley had passed along his DVD, said we were over in Finland shooting a remote. And we got this DVD submission. Why don't you watch it? I took a look at it. It was pretty good. But he was doing stand-up in his second language, which was English. This was not his first language.
Right.
And I actually asked him to send me some more in the future. And I guess this was, 9 years later, he sent me this set. And I couldn't go to see him. Mm-hmm. But he luckily was touring in the U.S. and was able to come by and tape. And it was a fantastic set.
9 years later. Was he literally out of mind kind of for that? Or did he keep in touch?
He kept in touch. There were emails here and there every once in a while. But it was somebody that I didn't know if we'd ever have the chance to get him on.
Wow.
And it just worked out. And sometimes I've had people that I've known on other shows, like say a Star Search, mm-hmm. that maybe 15 years later, booking them for this show is kind of a nice. It's nice
to see them again.
Yeah. Well, and that's I think a nice message for everybody is you might not get on the first time you submit, mm-hmm. but you know if you keep working at it, which you should, then eventually it can work out.
Yeah. I mean, it's you're doing something that's, I mean, these are comedians who perform live regularly, a number of times a week, multiple times a night.
Yeah.
And they're performing for audiences that are there to see stand-up comedy. They're performing for audiences that have been drinking. They're in a room mm-hmm. that really, I mean, sweetie, you can speak to this. It's very,
sure.
It's very conducive to a good intimate performance. Mm-hmm. Then you bring them here. It's the middle of the day. They're here to see Conan and or the celebrity. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're like saying, hey, here's this person you've never heard of. Doing a 5-minute set, you're not getting a chance to know them, and you've got to, hopefully this will go as well as it does in front of drunk people.
Right.
It doesn't always work that way, but you're trying to, I always equate it to, it's a different event at track and field. It's like you're used to running, if your hour set, you're used to running like the 2 mile, and suddenly here we've got a 50 meter sprint. You've got to. They're going to be analyzing every step that you take through from the first minute to minute five.
But it cuts the other way, too. There are acts that kill in clubs, mm-hmm. but on TV, they're almost too much. And it's kind of a cooler medium. And some comedians do better on television than they come across in clubs a lot of times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also not really the opportunity to do crowd work on our show. So it's, I mean, some comics are, it's that's rarely, where they really shine.
Yes. Yeah. It's tough. We do. I mean, it's nice that there have been a few that have been able to interact with the audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been when it's worked really well.
Yeah.
Crowd work is fascinating. I don't know if it's still the case, but the city of Boston, mm-hmm. no comic would do crowd work. It was almost like an unwritten rule. And there were clubs there. If you came from New York, because a lot of New York comics did crowd work, go to Boston. Like if you talk to the audience once, they'd be like, you don't do that. Oh. You don't do that in this club. And the crowd kind of knew that. Everyone was kind of like, what are you doing? You're breaking all the rules.
It's uncomfortable.
I kind of love how different. You probably notice this. There are almost different comedian personas mm-hmm. by city.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I think, is based on the live audiences they get to develop in front of. Because some, like San Francisco, those audiences, they're almost like Broadway theater crowds where they're like, oh, my God, this is I can't believe I'm out at a comedy club. Whereas New York, they're just staring at you or screaming at you.
Well, I think you mentioned San Francisco. I think there was a wave in the 90s. I noticed there was a lot more experimental comedians coming out of San Francisco mm-hmm. than out of New York or Boston or Chicago.
Absolutely. That was absolutely the case. And a lot of times they'd be flown in for Letterman auditions, mm-hmm. like a Catch Rising Star. And these acts that had developed in these really kind of pristine conditions would get thrown up in front of a crowd of drunk investment bankers and just hit the wall, and they went back to San Francisco. They were just stunned. The audience does, people have different theories on audiences. There is a variation night to night. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are certain nights where, and if you know who the comedian is going to be and how, you know, adventurous or experimental they are, and you can tell within the first two monologue jokes, oh, it's going to be rough for the comedian, or,
yep,
oh, they're going to have a great set. Don't you think?
Absolutely. There have been nights where I've just gone, oh boy, this is not the right night for them.
Oh, and you know that's going to happen, but they're still there, like, excited to go.
I
know.
And you don't want, you want to be careful about what you tell them. And so every once in a while, I'll have to read whether, you know, what I have to kind of figure out, is this the comic that you tell, this is not a good audience? You're really going to have to really hit these things hard, or you're going to have to, like, say, come up with a really good opening line to, like, win them over.
Yeah.
Or if you just, you've got to find the right balance, because you don't want to get in their head and tell them something that may just throw them off completely and make them panic. But you do also sometimes want to make sure they know what they're in for, because they will come out with their line that works every night, their opener that just always kills, and suddenly they get out there and it just thuds and they panic, and you don't want them to. So you may have to give that person a heads up that
it's
just be keep ready. Going.
It's so
don't
hard. Because for comics, if they know, oh, everyone else isn't doing well, then it is very liberating in a way. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, okay, I mean, this is going to be rough, but that thought of like, oh, it's just me, they just hate me. It's like, oh no, they hate they hate everybody, and that kind of relaxes you know. Mm-hmm. But it is very hard. I used to do the warm up back in New York, and Conan would be like, how are they, every single night.
Yeah.
And I always had to, it was a judgment call.
Right.
They'd have to be really bad for me to go, they're just off their assholes.
Yeah.
But, you know, because otherwise it's like running out to a brick.
They're great.
Wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
smashing.
And then suddenly
the
he's starting to doubt himself, going, what Sweeney said, they were amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'd be home by then.
Well, so you're the last, you're kind of the person that they connect with right before they go out. Is that, do you have a sort of process or routine for how you kind of psych them up for their
a prayer
spot? Yeah.
it really depends. I try to make them just remember that they've been doing this for, you know, decades, years, and they're used to this, and this is no different. It's not a bigger audience, and they perform for bigger audiences, and to try and not get overwhelmed by the fact that this is going to be broadcast and they're going to have to, like, you know, face their friends and their family afterwards if it doesn't go well, and just try to, like, tell them that, hey, this is, you've tested these jokes, you know they're great.
Yeah.
And just also don't rush and don't worry about the time cues. The biggest thing is that they sometimes will see time cues, and unlike just getting one red light at a comedy club, you've got a stage manager going 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute, wrap it up. And I try and just tell them, listen, just forget that.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes long, it's on me. We'll figure out a way to, like, you know, make it fit into the show, but don't you bail on the set and panic. And so that's usually the last thing I'm telling them before they go out there.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I didn't know you kind of give them that little final chat.
Usually, yeah. I mean, I give them, like, it depends on the person. Every personality is different. So I just try to read what I think.
Right. And a lot of them probably, it's like a fighter in a corner. They're like hearing every 10th word. They're like, yeah, sure. Yeah. Just let's get this over with.
Just punch send me out the there.
Do you tell them play to the camera, or do you play to the audience? Like, it's a live show and let the camera take care of itself. Well,
play the audience, but if you've got a line or some sort of, maybe if you're playing a character,
right,
and that character is directing something to you, then maybe if it works, play it to camera. But other than that, really play the room and make sure you engage the room, because if you look at comedy specials, rarely do you see anyone playing to the camera. I always try to treat it the same as you would a special, and also like you would treat a real room.
Yeah.
Yeah. The red light can be scary.
Oh my God.
The red light coming on, you know, there's five
the
cameras.
The tally light on the camera.
And the tally light, right. It's
the kill light.
It is. Why red? Maybe if it was a softer.
It's like a sniper's
like a nice
laser.
Turquoise blue.
Magenta maybe?
Yes, it'd be a little more relaxing. But it's red. It's angry. It's code 9.
Do you, JP, have any advice for someone out there who does stand up, who wants to get on late night and, you know, doesn't have any idea kind of how to make that happen?
Well, what I would do is just keep in mind that 4.5 to 5 minutes is a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So really, there's a lot of weight put on every bit, every joke.
Mm-hmm.
So I am always looking for something that's unique, someone that has something to say that hasn't been said 10,000 times. Obviously, it's not going to be the first time you've heard every joke, but you're saying it in a different way from other people. There are tried and well-trod bits and premises that I would avoid.
Mm-hmm.
It's often tough to kind of open your set with one of those because you may lose the audience right away. So it's really about trying something, going with something that's more unique. You really want to hit the ground with a really killer opener. And if you can, really end your set with a mic drop if you can. Find that line that the audience applause ends the set for you, that really you're not having to go,
that's it.
That's all I've got. And you can
commercial.
Yeah.
Tony for commercial.
Tony, please. That's really my advice for comics. Right. If a bit works in a 20-minute set, it may not work in a 5-minute set.
Right. So that's its own beast, is having a 5-minute.
It's very different.
And crafted.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like maybe true stand-up comedy, because it's not what you see in a stand-up club, it's your sort of business card, your calling card, mm-hmm. your invitation for people to come see you live and, maybe follow you if you host a podcast or if you've got mm-hmm. a special, download that.
That's awesome. Great.
Yeah.
And Moses said his appearance on the show really helped him as a calling card. You just used that term.
He said good. He started getting much better bookings after that.
Yeah. That's all I can wish for. Mm-hmm. That makes me happier than anything else, really. If someone comes off and says, you know what, someone saw this and booked me for another gig, that's the best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, this is so informative. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
That sounded like a really boring way to wrap things up. It actually was, guys. Assholes. Thanks, JP.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Wow. Yeah. So that was a great exclusive piece of advice for aspiring comics out there.
I hope thousands of people contact JP to be on the show now.
Yeah.
I think we've done a great service. And you can take a selfie with him. No questions asked.
That's it for this week's show.
Oh, wow. It's over
already. Can you believe it?
That's crazy.
It went by so fast.
That's insane. Now what do we do?
I don't know. I guess we have to go back to work.
Ugh.
One more thing before we go.
Yeah.
Moses Storm brought a really amazing home video of sorts.
Yes. It's hard to describe that video, but it does involve Conan. And
it does. And it's real. Great. It was for something he recorded as a youth.
Yes. And if you're a fan of Conan's old late night show, you'll love this clip.
So go to teamcoco.com to watch that. Or there's also a link in the show notes if you're lazy. Oh, and hey, this is new. If you want to contact us and you have a question or there's something you'd like to hear discussed on the show, you can do that now. We have a phone number. It's 323-209-5303 and an email, insideconanpod@gmail.com.
I can't believe they're using my home phone number for this. No one asked me.
So call Sweeney at any time of the night. He wants to hear from you.
I do.
Wait, Sweeney.
Yeah.
There's a breaking scandal that's taking place currently on... Check your email.
Let's see.
We have this ongoing issue where the third floor complains. We're on the third floor. The writers are on the third floor. And mm-hmm. Conan and Jeff and the producers are on the second floor.
The elites.
The elites. And they get much better snacks.
They get better everything.
And other
in their kitchen.
Perks. Yeah. And somebody just sent an email. Levi, one of our writers.
One of our writers. Wow.
It perfectly encapsulates the difference between the third floor and the second
floor. It's fantastic. This is a breaking scandal.
And the second floor has Coke Zero.
Right.
And the third floor has, I think
I don't
it's
know what that
Bond's
is.
Signature Select.
I don't know.
Zero calorie cola soda.
I think this soda comes from Albania. And Jeff Ross, our executive producer, has replied to this shot across the bow with, "That's unacceptable." And I don't know whether he's talking about Levi criticizing the second floor.
Yeah.
or the soda disparity.
I think when we get back to the office, Levi could be dead.
Murderer.
So this is, we're going to share that photo with you guys so that you can see that we're not making this up.
Yes, check it out.
They're going to try to gaslight us into thinking that we're crazy, but
when you see the conditions we are operating under on the third floor,
yes,
you might just want to send us money. I think.
At least contact
the close the gap.
Department of Labor on our behalf.
Yes, please. Los Angeles Department of Labor. Thank you.
And thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
We like you. Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Julia Smith and Kevin Bartelt.
Engineered by Will Becton and Sam Kiefer.
Mixed by Ryan Connor.
Supervising producer is Aaron Blair.
Executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Earwolf.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.